Hello, everybody. This is Megan, and welcome to Tea Time Crimes, the true crime podcast that explores women's stories under the lens of murder and mayhem. Each week, my co-host Alana and I delve into the psychology of killers, the strength of survivors, and everywhere in between.
Wait, what? I thought this was a tea podcast.
Oh, yeah. And Alana is left completely in the dark for each episode. So join us every week for a fascinating case with Alana's fresh perspective and a comprehensive yet accidentally comedic tea review.
I bring the tea and she brings the crimes.
Find us wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Tea Time Crimes out.
This podcast involves topics such as violence, sex, and mental illness. If these are likely to disturb you or those around you, please reconsider. The privacy and confidentiality of everyone discussed have been carefully protected, and demographics and other details have been changed whenever possible. If you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please call your local crisis center or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. You matter.
Hey, this is Kate. I know I just uploaded the other day saying I didn't know when I would be back, and I didn't know I would be back today, but somebody hacked my Instagram, and so I had to get down to my computer anyway to deal with that, which is fixed now. I'm just irritated. And so I thought, you know what? Let's get this episode out. Let's do a thing. So that when I go back upstairs and I lie down and I do my imitation of a potato for the rest of the day, that I've accomplished something. That helps my mental health quite a bit. And, you know, I'm not going to make any promises about when I'll accomplish something again next, but this is today. That intentionality of self-definition and what makes me and what makes me matter and what makes me important, that all fits very nicely with this episode as well. Plus, to be honest, it took very little editing, so that helps. But I'm talking with Benoit Kim, who has become a good friend of mine. He has a podcast called Discover More, and it's fundamentally seated in the idea of having conversations intentionally. Bring yourself and pay attention and engage and see what happens. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
My name is Benoit Kim. I am a pan-educated policymaker formerly who really wanted to develop my life and my effort mentally and physically to help spearhead and change how marginalized and disproportional the landscape is becoming in the U.S. through a socioeconomic lens. Then through my work as a policymaker after attending school at Penn, I realized that a lot of the societal issues I was deeply, deeply passionate about were actually byproduct of unattended mental health issues. Whether that's stigma, intergenerational trauma, poverty, or some combination thereof. And I was able to pinpoint the root cause that bridged all those domains, which was mental health. So now I work as a psychotherapist in Los Angeles. And 3 years ago, I started a podcast by simply leaning into curiosity. Because I think about 3-4 years ago, it was the true start of this deep chasmic divide between America, left and right, Democrats, Republican, whatever you want to label them or adjectives you want to use. And I realize it comes down to our lack of ability to have a conversation as a fellow human being under this container of a humanity. So I thought, why don't I start a podcast with a friend? I'm very cognitive. I've always been this esoteric lifelong learner. I've had interest from astrophysics to psychology, to physics, to human emotions. But then as the hierarchy of ignorance goes, we were mid-20s at the time. So what do we know about this world? So we gradually shifted the podcast as a passion project of just having conversations intentionally with my co-founder at the time, who later split last year, into now having wide-ranging conversations similar to Kate's show with people who I deem as fascinating, who I deem as doing the unconventional thing, career, professionally, or interpersonally, and try to dissect and synthesize some practical mental health takeaways. Because everyone and their mothers now have a podcast, and everyone and their mother is a self-proclaimed guru and expert. So I want to really differentiate my show in terms of the practical lens where, no, this isn't just motivation porn. It's not just inspirational, more and more one after another. But by tuning in, you can actually take away tangible that's pragmatic, practical. They can hopefully improve your life by discovering more about what you want to discover more about. And that led us to this very moment, sitting across the computer from you, Kate.
Do you, when you set up, and I kind of know the answer to this, but for listeners, when you set up recordings with people, do you have talking points? Do you know where you want the conversation to go?
It's twofold, right? So part of me, I do, based on this intuitive feeling where we talked about this briefly before the recording started, where through intentionality, there is this natural unfolding process. And after a while, there is this natural closing point. So intuitively, yes. In addition to that, my show is a little bit longer. I do a 1.5 hour recording time typically. So I do have about 5 to 7 anchor points to guide our conversations through, since it is unscripted. But I do want to do my due diligence and prepare accordingly, because time is scarce and I don't want to talk about things very aimlessly. So I do have some preparation beforehand, but I think the magic they're alluding to happens actually in the show as it unfolds.
Have you had conversations that felt aimless or unimportant? On mic, I mean, not like,
yeah.
I have children, and so I have conversations daily that feel aimless, but for your show. And I don't name names, but where does that come from?
So maybe not unimportant, because I think the quality of the answers or responses or the stories that we uphold are predicated on the questions that we ask. So I've had some more lackluster air quote questions. And a lot of that, I think, is because of my inability to really facilitate what the guest had to offer in like the first half of my podcasting journey. I just entered my 3.5 years. So I would say for the last year, I haven't had a single conversation that I deemed as air quote unworthy or not interesting or unimportant.
See, I've gotten better at, there are definitely early on some that I had where even in the moment and then definitely later through the editing process, I would be thinking like, I'm missing something. It's not there. It's not right. And I have a certain, it's not a list, it's not written down, but I have some sort of unwritten rules, I guess, of things I don't want to do. For instance, if you had a book out, I do not want to ask, so what made you want to write?
right?
Like, I don't want to ask insipid questions. I also don't want to ask things like, you got to start with softball questions. But if I'm still sort of casting about half an hour, 45 minutes in, and I'm still sort of not in the moment, but I'm thinking, what am I going to ask next? Then I'm not in it. I'm not focused. And I realized that this must have been 2 or 3 years ago now. And by the time this episode comes out, I will have crossed 5 years myself. So we are both geriatric podcasters. And I had an author, and it was just not happening. It was just not clicking. Mm. For me, a conversation feels like playing catch. And it should be with a tennis ball or a kickball or a soccer ball. And with this particular person, it felt like I was playing catch with a bowling ball. And you know, with great effort, I would lift it up and I would hurl it in their direction, and it would land with a thump at their feet. And I'd be like, could you Could you pick that up? That conversation, could you pick it up and toss it back at me? And they would do it and it would land at my feet. And I was like, this is the most uninspired thing that I've ever experienced. And at the end of it, after I hit stop, I asked her, I was like, I feel like that didn't go ideal. Like, I feel like my read is that you feel uncomfortable. You know, am I wrong? And she's like, well, I've never done any promotion before. This is my first ever interview. And I'm like, lady, you gotta tell me these things. Like, please tell me. Tell people if you're nervous. Tell people if you're not, because I know how to make people more comfortable. And that was a huge learning moment for me about, don't assume that just because someone has approached me and said, I want to come on your show, that they're ready to record.
Yeah. And I think you speak to a bigger issue where I do talk about this offline, where we currently live in this podcasting renaissance, air quote, where everyone and their mothers are starting a podcast. Some TikTokers has some overnight success based on 15-second reels. So they said, oh, let me start a long-form conversations. And of course, that conversion never works. But what I mean by that is 4 years ago, if you started a podcast, everyone's opener is, oh, tell me what you do. Tell me the genesis of your story. Tell the listeners about your background. When I come across those podcasts now, I'm surprised they're still around, because that doesn't work. That worked 4 years ago, because it was less saturated, people's attention were much longer, where they can handle this 20-minute buildup and then get to the hook or the gist of what the content is. And that doesn't work now. And of course, we have to adapt. And this is a very privileged and cool thing that we started as just having these conversations and now with this business prospect. But yeah, I agree with you that I do feel like the landscape is changing and the way people are able to retain or stay longer with us is also shifting over time. And I think that responsibility falls onto us who have these platforms to create this most conducive, welcoming, and valuable space, because time is scarce. And I don't want to waste anyone's time, let alone mine or the listener's time as well.
Do potential guests, when you approach them, do you ever have someone to tell you, oh, I don't know, I'm boring?
Let me think. I'm such a hyper intentional person that I think that would have been weeded itself out in my vetting process. I do a 15 to 30 minute discovery call, play on words, discover more, although that's not really trademarked. It's a lot of people use that terminology. So I use that as a process to really vet that process out. Because once again, without being intentional about it, I don't want to, aside from analytics, mutually beneficial components, all this networking aside, I don't want to waste someone else's time if they don't have a lot to offer, or maybe it's not even the right platform for them. Just because what the analytics says, that doesn't necessarily translate to a quality and fun conversations.
So there's where you and I take different paths through the woods. Because for me, if someone tells me, oh no, I'd be boring. First of all, I've asked for a reason. Like, I've had people approach me, and that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. And my answer is mostly yes, unless you're on my no list. And then sorry about it. But if I've decided to approach somebody, I never check their analytics. I never check their audience size. I never check the likelihood of it being beneficial to my growth as a podcaster in terms of downloads and the like, because that stresses me out. It leads too quickly down the path for me, the way my brain works, of which is your favorite episode? And I hate that question, because the answer is doesn't matter. Sometimes my favorite ones have the fewest downloads. Sometimes the ones with the most downloads are ones where I was like, that was incredibly lame and, you know, surface level, shallow, no good. But if I have someone where I really like their social media presence, or they're a listener of the show where we've had a good conversation, and this has happened before where I've said, you know what, you should come on my show. Why don't you come play? Oh, I don't know what we would, I don't know what we're going to talk about. Like, I'm pretty boring. And I'm like, okay, that's just a flat out dare. That's my job. That's my role as host, is to pull the stories out, give you a platform where you feel okay. And the answer is I can take no. And including, I've had at least two or three times with people who are now on the no list, by the way, who we started talking and I realized, oh, I don't like this. this doesn't feel good. I'm trying to think of an example that isn't too, so one example is, for instance, my first year in podcasting, I ended up with a stalker. And so that's when I started asking people about, what, do you want to be anonymous? Just because I don't have to tag people on social media for it to be a decent episode. I just want to ask, I want to know, and I want to know that top line. It's the first thing I write down, so that if they want to be anonymous, I know it right up front, no question. And I ask, but I don't get into the stalker thing. I have before, but that's sort of 4 years ago now, almost. It's old news. And but I asked this one woman, and I said, do you want to be anonymous? And she said, why would you ask that? Although sharper than that, she got fairly intense with me. And I was just like, well, look, it's your privacy. It's your, you can tell your story without giving me your name. And I can share your story without sharing your name. And I said something to the effect of that I've had, I myself, as well as close friends of mine, have experienced stalking and inappropriate behavior online. You know, having the audacity to appear as a woman on the internet is a dangerous thing sometimes. Right. And she was like, oh, you get stalkers? I don't want stalkers. I don't want to be on your show. And I was like, okay, bye. Like, it was the weirdest, like, intense, like, clearly I had clicked a nerve there.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I think it's going to be great, and it turns out we're not meshing, we can't do this. But more often, much more often, I have people tell me, I don't have anything to say. I don't have a story. I don't have anything interesting to say. I'm pretty shy. I'm pretty boring. And I'm like, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know? And so to me, that's almost like a dare.
Yeah, I will. To that woman, it sounds more of like an emotional reflex, right? You did probably touch something deeper than just that anonymous question. I've never had any guest that I reached out to after my prep and research that, oh, I'm too boring. But especially with professors and academics I have on the show, which is often the securing chapter in life I'm at, I've had way too many people say, what? Your booking slot is an hour and a half? When am I going to talk about myself for an hour and a half? A, I know that's the right people that I want to have on the show because they don't have this self-centered narcissistic focus that, oh, let me talk about me, me, me. So that itself is already a great cue that, okay, I'm talking to the right people. And then I tell them as a, not as similar to a dare, I said, oh, you don't think you have enough to say? Bring yourself and let me take care of the rest. And after the 1.5 hour recording ends, you be the judge and you tell me that you had, you were able to provide any value to the listeners. So it's not of a boring, but I do have a lot of people are scared of the time commitment, which speaks to the landscape that we live in, where an hour and a half of having an intentional, immersive conversation is now even perceived as burdensome to a lot of these hyper-intellectuals and academic folks. And I think that speaks to a greater deficit of this world that we live in now, where people are more and more used to these superficial surface conversations where we just talk about the weather for half the conversations, or how was your day? How was the dinner? And we don't really go deep enough, which I do think that why podcasting is one of the last frontiers that's left, for lack of better words. At least that's why I really believe in the art of podcasting, because it is art, though the creative element is more nuanced and only unveils to those like this more seasons, I think, after... You have to release more than 6 episodes to understand what we're talking about here.
You have to get past it. I use the word every chance I get because I'm stupid proud of it. You have to get past being a poddler.
That's a good one.
Right. But for real, they. I remember before I started my show, I asked a lot of people, because I listened to a lot of podcasts, what do I do? How do I get ready? How did you start? What did you, you know, and just sort of decide, like, what is the time commitment I'm looking at? And also just, what are the actual steps to take? How do you choose a host? How do you choose whether or not to monetize? How do you get episode art? All the, you know, just asking a lot of questions to that sense. And one of the pieces of advice I got from several people out there was, well, record 10 episodes and throw them out. You just made a face. I made the same face of like, oh, what? Like, and for me, it was like, absolutely not. For that, there's something about podcasting, this style, this conversational style, that's so in the moment,
right?
That It's only happened. I've lost one complete episode where my computer crashed and I lost the whole episode. And we did re-record, and I can tell. I've never asked. I didn't ask listeners. Like, can you tell that was kind of faked? Because I can tell it was kind of faked. Because at the moment, I was like, well, look, I frankly don't care. But you know, I still wanted to give this guest their platform. It's just, it was so much more work. And for me, I know my first 10 episodes are not great in terms of audio. It took me 6 months to a year to really get a reliable setup. That's okay. I'm not going to get rid of those early episodes. And I'm also not going to tell people, like, don't listen to those, or they're terrible sound, because they're good things that are said in those episodes. Stick with that. Stick with what's said. And that's not going to be a piece of advice that I've ever given another podcaster, is go ahead, do the work, and then throw it out.
Yeah, because I this is very nuanced, but I think so my love for podcasting has grown exponentially now than when I first started. And of course, paralysis by analysis, all these buzzwords that people throw around, and there is validity to that. Like, if you get paralyzed to overthinking, overanalyzing the mic equipment, the lighting, the backdrop, all these things, a hosting platform, excuses are endless. If you want, you can literally have years and years and years of excuses, right? That stops you from doing what you want to do. So I knew, me and my co-founder at the time, we knew that we had to create a point of no return. What that means is we had to have this externalizing moment to get us off of our ass and actually trying to change the internal into the external reality. So we recorded our first two episodes on our iPhone mic. The audio quality is horrendous. I tell people, do not listen to the first few episodes because they sound horrible. And it took so much more editing to make it sound, air quote, good, and to provide value. Because, you know, filler words, and all of these intricate things, a lot of people just unaware of. When you watch Netflix, listen to these established podcasts, you don't really know how much work goes into it. But yeah, the idea of throwing out 10 episodes is bonkers to me, because one of the things that saddens me as a podcaster is I know deep inside that whatever the magic I experienced with a guest virtually or in person will never be seen or felt by the listeners. The listeners come here for the content and the volume, but that magic is only unique for two of us right now. And it's not for anyone else. And it, of course, it's not everyone's job to feel it. But the idea of throwing that conversations out and for the respect, or not the respect, to be respectful of the effort and the time that people gave just for the sake of practicing, that, I don't know, that doesn't seem aligned with what I believe in, but to people's own way, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that there are so many, as you said, your love of podcasting has increased. So we're doing this thing. My brain gets multiple questions at once. I'm going to try and tease just one out. And that is, prior to starting my own podcast, I pretty much listened to nonfiction, things that I knew about. So psychology, criminal justice, some true crime, if they weren't dicks about it. That kind of, like, a fairly narrow swath of what was out there. And over time, my podcatcher, I can hear it sort of wince a little bit when I pick it up, when I start to scroll, like, because I'll hear, you know, either an ad or a guest on another show, or I'll see somebody online and they'll say, oh, I have a podcast. Well, I'll listen. I'll give it a try. I've learned to let go of, I used to have sort of a almost obsessive need to listen to all of the episodes because I wanted to hear the full arc. I wanted to hear how you sounded when you started and how you are now. And I've let that go some because there's only so many minutes in a day. But I've also just expanded. Like, I listen to actual play podcasts now. I listen to audio drama. I listen to some humor, although often I'm listening at night. And the a lot of comedy podcasts struggle, I think, with the volume levels, the gain between speech and laughter. And I don't like that at 3 in the morning, you know, because I'll just drift off and then they're laughing at me and that's not great.
Like, yeah. Right.
So that for me, it's that, yes, I am more into podcasts than I ever was before, but also my interest in podcasting has diversified a lot. Do you feel like you've done that, or do you feel like you've sort of stayed in your lane?
Yeah, that's a great question. So before I ask that, it's so funny you talked about this obsessive need to enjoy the entire arc, the progression of the context. The only one podcast that I've listened to from the beginning until the end was the Tim Ferriss Show. Of course, all of us owe a certain level of gratitude towards him for pioneering this space. And of course, Joe Rogan and other greats out there who are doing podcasting for the right reasons, aside from their reputations, where it took me 2 years to catch up all of whatever episodes that Tim Ferriss has been producing for the past 10 years. And I realized I could never do that again because the opportunity cost is massive. But yeah, I do think context is important. But yeah, to answer your question, I think my love for the podcasting has grown in both ways. So yes, I listen to more different type of podcasts than the ones that first drew me in, which is very personal development centric, like behavior optimizations, mindset focused, because that's just who I am. I'm very cognitive. I'm a psychotherapist in real life. I love these type of knowledges. And I think I just appreciate language more. So I listen to a lot of these language podcasts, talks about like Hidden Brain is another podcast I listen to. It talks about language and brain psychology, neuropsychology, because I realized podcasting is an art, even though a lot of air quote artists won't admit that podcasting is an art, because it's a little bit more not traditional, which I disagree with. Is example, like, let's think about what language is. And I'd love to hear your thoughts as a psychologist yourself as well, where language is this arbitrary tool. It's man-made. It's a construct. It's a tool based on the need, right? Because the necessity is the mother of all invention, is how the quote goes, where it's a created tool by some folks a long time ago that allows you and I with different skin tone, different genetic makeup, different upbringing to communicate what's internal, externally, across the screen or in person. That blows my mind because I speak 3.5 languages. Because I spent my childhood in 4 different countries and 3 different continents. That's why my name is French. So language has always fascinated me. So in that sense, I think my love for podcasting is more about, wow, based on different people's interests, interpretations, and what they read and the way they talk, their style of stylistic choices of words, you can convey the same message in so many different ways. And so many different people can derive so many different things from the same construct of just words, because words are made up. That blows my mind. And I think that's like the best way to capture how my love for podcasts has grown, is it's just so nuanced. And the things that I love now is things I never even knew would be possible 3.5 years ago. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's more about the essence of podcasting versus the genre, as what you alluded to earlier.
Sure. No, well, and it's always been interesting to me that for myself, with my own personal background, that I got into podcasting because I suffered a traumatic brain injury in 2010 and spent 1.5 weeks in a coma. Mm. And when it came out, I had complete aphasia. No words. I could understand simple questions, but, and I could even understand that I was supposed to know the answer. So if someone says to you, what's your name? You can't not think of your name. You can choose not to say it, but it's there. It's a reflex. It's part of how your brain does. And for me, they would say it, what's your name? And I'd be like, nothing. Just static, just like the Meow Mix theme song would run in my head. Like I had no idea. And over the span of a couple of days, it started to come back a little at a time. And obviously now I don't stop talking, so we're good. But but I had to relearn in many ways. And one of the things that I've noticed is that, like, I still have complete retrograde amnesia for the year leading up to the brain injury, but I remember prior to that. And that part of being a good assessment clinician, which was my specialty, is learning all of the jargon and then never using it, right? Because you have to know it in order to communicate it to colleagues and judges and write papers and the like. But then every time I did a forensic evaluation or a crisis evaluation, or for a little while I ran a learning disabilities ADHD clinic, and I would bring my write-up to the client or the inmate or the patient, and I would say, I want you to read this. I want you to recognize yourself in this. And that means you can't use the jargon. It has to make sense. And so now I lean into that even heavily. I think that's a skill that carried me through the aphasia. So now with podcasting, there are other podcasters in the psychology, self-help, mental health space that say really, really interesting things in an incredibly boring way.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't want to listen to this. I don't want to, like, I'm not paying to go back to school, and they're not paying me to listen. So this shouldn't be work. You know, it can be effort without work, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's part of what started to pull me out of. So first, I only listened to nonfiction because that's all I understood. Early on, after the brain injury, I had a very hard time understanding fiction. Mm. The more sci-fi fantasy it got, the less I could follow it. And so I started asking people, like, give me a good story. Give me a show that tells a good story in a setting that I would never be in. And the first one I listened to is by my friend Sarah. It's called Girl in Space. And I love her tagline because she is brilliant. It's about a girl in space. Right. And I was terrified to listen because it had been so hard for me to read fiction and understand fiction and be able to make that adjustment to suspend disbelief, but then pick it back up again. You know, the let go of the disbelief and then pick the disbelief back up again when it was the right time. And Sarah's a master for storyteller. And I was like, I can do this. I can follow this. Okay, let's go. And that's when I learned it wasn't entirely about genre. It wasn't at all about genre, really. It was about the language. Do you speak in a way that draws me in? And because I am mostly deaf, I really don't care about the audio quality, although I understand that it's important to people. And so I do the best that I can. I accept my own limitations. And then we roll on. And it's that playing with language and playing with concepts, playing with ideas. It's fascinating to me. And that's part of why I don't have talking points for myself when I'm with people. It's because I find, again, going back to that tendency, I don't have OCD, but I sort of lean in that direction a little bit. If I get too stressed out, I tend to get a little bit stuck in, I have to do this checklist. I have to do all of these things in this order. And so if I start with a list of talking points, I get stuck in there, and I'm pointing as though that helps the listening audience, whatever, but I get stuck, you know, point one, point two, point three. And that's not where the magic is. That's thinking about what I want to talk about in advance, and that's fine. But the magic happens between you and I in the moment. It's the space between us and what I think to ask and what you think to say and rolling the ball along.
Yeah, there's so many there. So my brain's also splitting into six different directions. But like a quick flow state, I used to talk extensively about flow states on the show 2 years ago now. I haven't talked about it in a while because we have too much content out there. But simply put, flow state requires a certain level of preparation, discomfort, and surrender. You have to surrender for the flow state to appear. And that is a fact based on the studies and literature that we have. But yeah, I just want to, if you don't mind, I'd love to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
So I read Adam Grant, a prolific organizational psychologist at Wharton, one of the youngest tenured professor in Wharton's history, brilliant scholar, brilliant thinker. He wrote a book called Think Again a couple years ago now, I think. Time is loose after the pandemic. And basically the premise of the book, the SparkNotes version, is unlearning or unprogramming is more difficult than programming and conditioning. And you have to unlearn, right? A lot of times, a lot of idiosyncrasies, a lot of beliefs, what we hold as truth by worshiping them on an altar, are just instilled opinions by others that we internalize as facts or truth or whatever. So like for your experience after TBI, traumatic brain injury, and the recovery process, like what if you could recall and if you can retrace those steps, like what was like the most memorable or remarkable reprogramming process that you went through trying to almost reacquire language? Because as you said, if that makes sense.
It wasn't so much, I don't recall language specifically, like it came back pretty quickly. To me, the biggest challenge was that I have a lesion in my right frontal lobe now that was not there before. I'm pointing like people can see, it's right there. and the person that I was before, I went to an engineering school as an undergrad, and I was super organized and I did to-do lists and everything was very structured and very, like I said, I ran a learning disabilities ADHD assessment clinic. And then after developing the lesion, I also have epilepsy now because of it. Now I have ADHD, which fundamentally has shifted my personality in ways. I am more impulsive than I used to be. I'm more emotional than I used to be. I'm more easily frustrated. I'm more impacted by whether I'm tired. I have had to learn different ways of approaching things. So as a for instance, if I had decided to start a podcast 15 years ago, if that was a thing, me being who I was, I would have written a very detailed list with like bullet points and subheadings and like different shaped bullets for different levels. And it would have been all
different colors,
you know? Yeah, absolutely. And you get me. And like, I would have known all kinds of things that I wanted to specifically and deliberately bring up with every given guest. And I probably would have listened to the rules, capital T, capital R, the rules of podcasting, which are things like you have to release on the same day, either every week or every other week. You have to have a regular release time. You have to have a certain approach. You have to have, you know, to tone and style. You have to have certain, you know, like there were these sort of have to's and should's. And instead I was like, you know what? They told my husband to start planning the funeral in 2010. Mm-hmm. I'm not supposed to be alive. And I seem to be. So let's drop those rules. And it was for episode, I think, 7 of my podcast, where I was still trying to follow the what fits for me versus what other people tell me I should do. And it was my first sort of planned out semi-formal collaboration with another creator, which, by the way, absolutely podcasters are artists. I use creators as sort of my umbrella term for all of it, for whether you create visual art or music or podcasts, you are a creator, you are creative. I'm not taking any questions. But the people that I was working with, they released on like Wednesdays at midnight Central Time. And we recorded separate audio for each show. So they said, we'll release ours at midnight, you release yours at midnight. Okay, got it, go. And I was like, sure, no problem. And I didn't give any thought to the fact that this was the first time that I had edited with 3 speakers instead of 2. And it was a different format than I had done before that. And just, there was a lot of things about it. Plus, it was the first sort of deadline that I had imposed upon myself. And I stressed so hard on it. I worked and I worked and I stressed and I worked some more and I stressed, and it was effort and it was not fun. And I remember thinking, I don't want to do this. If this is what podcasting is. Like I really enjoyed the earlier episodes and I liked the process of creating this, but I'm not liking the editing publishing part. But I got it done. I hit publish and I record in my basement, which is now finished and looks all pretty, but it used to be unfinished basement storage playroom area. And so I'm all done. I shut down my computer and I go upstairs and I shake my husband awake, 2 a.m. or whatever my time. And he's like, you okay? And I said, no. And I had a seizure.
Wow.
And it was because I stressed myself out so much. I'd pushed beyond my own physical and mental capacity. And that's when I realized, you know what? Those rules, capital R rules, they cannot apply to me. And so I had to unlearn them. And that was very important to unlearn the shoulds and to not force myself to fit into a mold that works for many other people. And great, I'm delighted for them. It doesn't work for me. And if I try to force myself into that mold, I'm just going to be miserable all the time.
Yeah. And that speaks to the death of nuances, right? Every advice needs to be contextualized. Like the capital T, capital R, the rules that I also abided by strictly for the first year and a half. And then I realized, wait a minute, I had this inkling and I stretched around based on the circumstances of life, because all of us, we're not just podcasters. We have a family, fiance, you got to put food on the table. We have other life issues at bay. And I switched on my schedule out of necessity and didn't see any changes to my listenership at the time, at least. And I realized just like the nuances, oh, you should do this only if. We don't have that only if context or this added notes. But yeah, I think what you're talking about is, at least the way I see it, is compounding. Like Naval Ravikant, he's a prolific American investor, great, great thinker. He has a podcast called Just Naval. He talks about all best things in life compound over time. Relationships, investments, your portfolio, your retirement fund, index fund, whatever, they compound over time. But if you go a little bit deeper, the journey compounds, like the skill sets, the experiences, the competency, the nuances, they also compound over time. So what that means is for us to reap the maximum benefits of this exponential compounding growth, we have to stay in the game. The only way for compounding to stop compounding is if you pull yourself out or if you disrupted that process. So for me, at least, I think about this all the time where last 2 months, at least on my podcasting end, I experienced 10x growth, analytically, listenership, because of a lot of growth strategies and experimentations I did. But it was so stressful, Kate. It was so, so stressful. And when I experienced this 10x growth that I could even dream about, I had 2 seconds of appreciation and I said, okay, next growth strategies. But if you play that out over time, if you iterate that, what happens if because of this self-inflicted, as you said, because no one's holding guns against our heads, these are all us, right? It's our inner demons chatting at us. The worst thing that I could do or you could do, I think as creatives or doing this thing that's bigger than us, in our case is art of podcasting, the worst disservice that we can do is if we stop. And that could be because of stress. So I view it as longevity is the end goal because I want to do this in perpetuity. There is so many people haven't asked questions. There's so many people haven't said across the screen. So I have to be sustainable. And that comes down to mental health, right? Emotional health, sustainability. And goes back to the language. What's sustainability? Sustaining what you're doing for a long time. That's sustainability. So I resonate with everything that you said on a different level, but yeah.
Are there things that you were told when or before you started out that you have had to unlearn, like whether that's tangible or whether it's more esoteric?
Podcasting or outside?
Sure.
Oh, how much time do we have? Let's see. Let's start with podcasting since that's the frequency we're on right now. With podcasting, I think the worst advice that I had to unlearn after about 2 years is simultaneously establish your presence on every social media outlet, do all these things, build out a website. That's the go-to advice if you go to how to start a podcast on Google University. That's their starter kit. Worst advice because... yes, having a social media presence creates a social proof, which is needed. That's the era we live in, whether we like it or not. It doesn't really actually help the growth, the show, and doesn't help you refine your art. So I actually had to unlearn that and had to pivot or switch my effort more towards the actual refinement of this craftsmanship versus this social media elusive thing that doesn't work, doesn't not look, it looks cool, but is it actually having any impact? The answer was no. So succinctly put, focusing on analytics or social media the first year, meaningless. Because most people don't even want to talk to you if your show is under a year to begin with. So tangibly put, that's for the podcasting. In life, man, that's a vast question. I think, especially as an Asian American, I think, or as an American, where identity politics is pretty big, whether you're the left or right, whatever your political ideologies are. And I see the reason for identity politics, like that's what it's a box, right? oh, here's a box. Here's the marginalized people based on history, economic status, whatever, and let's boost them up. That's the very pure, oversimplified reason for identity politics. But now it's very deserving of many populations. Like, oh, you're an Asian because that's your skin pigmentations, whatever. But there's so much nuances and so much intricacies historically, politically, within just this genre or this box or mold of Asians. So I think I had to learn to really unlabel and burn down as many boxes as possible. And that's an ongoing process. And that sounds simple, but it's very, very difficult and it's not easy. And I'll, for instance, my current pathway that I'm on in terms of unlearning for the past 2 years, I'm 30 now, is I want to disassociate myself internally as this smart guy. Because yes, I went to one of the best schools just on paper. I have a certain way of thinking. I'm very cognitive. I'm very reflective. And I like reading a lot of books. I'm a ferocious reader. At the same time, what does that smart mean? Because like America is great at robbing words and language, like holistic health. What does that mean? It's just a buzzword that a lot of life coaches throw around. Love. What does love mean, right? And I think we have to really neutralize a lot of these languages. So now what I'm working on is, yes, I know I'm smart, whatever that means to people. And yes, I know I have a certain level of cognitive ability, way of thinking, looking at things, but I want to neutralize and I want to make sure that my self-worth and who I am is not associated with any boxes, whether that's your career, in my case, cognitive ability or job. And I think that's a process I'm going to embark on for many more years. Because it's not easy, right? But yeah, that's something I've been working a lot about intentionally the past couple of years in terms of deconditioning, unconditioning myself from these things that has been put on a pedestal, at least in my culture, by my parents.
So I don't think I finished the explaining earlier when I was saying language and its challenges or whatever, that I don't recall recovering language as being the challenge for me. The challenge for me was very much what you're describing now, of abandoning the demographic expectations. I was the smart kid. I was the eldest sibling. I was the this, I was the that, you know, those sorts of things. I was a woman working in a man's world, that kind of, those sorts of things. And for a while after the coma and after the TBI, I still, like, I knew how to act like I had it together. I knew how to try to still be that person in certain ways, but often it was because there was a feedback loop that would happen, because when you react in a way that the people around you don't think is right by mm-hmm. Visual quotes, right, the way they expect you to based on their accumulated knowledge of you, they give you a look.
Right.
That sort of double, you know, sort of side eye, you know, you're not being the Kate we know. What's, and I'd be like, yeah, you know why? Like, my brain broke.
Yep.
But for the first year to year and a half, I took that criticism, which they were perfectly, and some of these were very close family members, they were perfectly willing for me to own that criticism and to say, I'll try harder, I'll get better, I'll recover. Mm. And then there came a point, and I don't, like, not a point in time that I recall, but there came a point where I realized, all due respect, fuck this.
Right.
Like, that's who I was. And that's important. I worked hard to become that person and to reach certain things, but that's not who I am now. And I can spend all of my time masking and faking and pretending that it's not hard for me to pay attention and pretending that I'm not frustrated and pretending that words aren't really, really difficult for me all the time. They're still challenging. I've just gotten better with them than I used to be. And that I wasn't doing anyone else, like, maybe it was making their lives easier. Great. Don't care. I don't live with those people and my husband and kids accept me as I am. So how about I just live my life? And if that's not good enough, okay, like, that's how to, in coming to that of, okay, I'm not going to take on that role as the sort of hardcore woman working in a man's prison sort of persona anymore. And I'm not going to worry about saying the right thing the first time all the time. Sometimes I stutter, sometimes I misspeak, and I think we all have to give ourselves grace as well as we give each other grace to say, wait, hang on, can I restate that? I don't feel like I got my point across, or I don't think I understand what you're asking. And learning how to say, I don't understand your question. That's something I did in my late 30s, because up until then, I was always the smart one. Like, I always understood the question. And learning that it's okay not to, and it's okay to ask, and it's better, in fact, more respectful to ask and make sure you understand the question before you just go, you know, and answer the wrong thing, or in a way that they're not looking for, or whatever it may be. And so exactly that sort of dismantling of these expectations that other people hold of me and demonstrate by their reactions to me, as well as the expectations that I'm holding of myself. And I don't know which was harder, because I very deliberately stopped caring about other people's expectations of me. And I feel like, look, as long as I can sort of tread gently on the physical ground as well as with the people around me, and I know I'm doing my best, and I try to find the redeeming positives. I try to spin things. So if someone tells me, oh, I'm terrible at this, okay, let's talk about what that makes you good at instead. No, I'm terribly anxious. Oh, so that means you pay really good attention to what's going on around you. Things like that. Then I've reached a goal, and if I fail on a day, then we're going to try again tomorrow. And that's not something I'm good at. Even now, it's been almost 13 years, and I'm not good at being gentle with myself and giving grace to myself. But I feel like that's a parallel to what you're talking about, is that let's stop pigeonholing myself in this box of what I am and therefore what I'm not, and being like, well, maybe.
Yeah, once you make a PSA, public service announcement, for both of our sake, where of course change is the only constant, chaos theory or otherwise, but change is never easy. A lot of people call me the de facto pivoting guy. I pivoted my career 3 times in the last 7 years. Not jobs, I pivoted careers, which costed me 2 master's degrees. And financial, that's a different discussion, right? But at the same time, I constantly have this internal metrics or this internal evaluation process. I do quarterly basis, sometimes annually, where have I changed this year? And of course, you have to contextualize this. What does that mean? Is sure, the only version of the people you want to compare with is your past self. We've heard that trope before. And sure, it's a trope, but there's a lot of truth there. And we need to first internalized and accept this truth, universal truth, that change is truly the constant and change is good, both internally and externally. I want to become a more improved or a different version of myself year by year. Sometimes the timeline is different. And for people who are witnessing that, in your case, Kate, it's your family members or what may. And of course, there's a certain level of discomfort, because if there's a change, our internal map, reality map, has to adapt to that change. And that creates a certain level of discomfort. And it's not easy. But imagine the people, aka you, who are going through that change directly versus these people who are witnessing your change. So anytime I witness my friends or family members who are changing, air quote, or who are being different than the preconceived versions according to my map, at least I metacognitively, I don't say, oh, why are they being so weird? Oh, why are they being like that? Instead, I try to ask, because it's not easy. I try my best to ask, huh, interesting. You're very different than the last time I saw you, behaviorally, emotionally, whatever. I ask questions. Can you tell me about, did anything happen the last couple years, couple months? You seem a little bit different. Just like Kevin Hart's, right? A lot of cancel culture, a lot of people were canceled because they were a different version of themselves than 10 years ago, which is a great thing. But a lot of society at large doesn't view it that way. But I do really feel like the pandemic, a lot of these issues come down to cognitive rigidity, the way I think about it. And I really, this is a general blanket statement, but I do really believe that mental health, emotional health, life, the hardships, and the self-inflicted pain comes down to our resistance or our unwillingness to adapt and we want to double down on our this rigid, inflexible worldview. And you can't replace that worldview with whatever language you want to use. But yeah, I hope that us as a country, people just get past this point of contention and just ask one more question, be a little bit more curious and be more gracious towards other people's change. I read an article about 2 months ago about even now, 78% of us show more grace and extend more understanding and compassion towards others versus ourselves. What does that tell us of our society, right? And of course, that's better than more narcissistic or other problematic things. But yeah, I do feel like we need to first learn to accept the good, the bad, and the ugly. Otherwise, we're going to translate that into having this often high and unrealistic expectations of others to embrace us for who we are. But we have to embrace us who we are. Otherwise, people are not going to be able to do that for us.
I really liked the challenges that this had. Like, I recorded this before I got sick. And so at the time, being unwell and being disengaged was in my rearview mirror. It wasn't something I was thinking about as a current state. But then I just spent something like 14 out of the last 40 days actively inpatient on a medical surgical floor in the hospital, and another 6 days in the ER. So I've had a lot of downtime. I am not the kind of person, usually, who can lie still and stare at the wall and do nothing. I don't meditate well, but I also don't just stare at the TV or just let time pass. Like, I can't look at a book. I have to be pulled in. I can't passively listen to a podcast. I have to really focus on what is happening. And so when I hit a point where I'm moving through the world, but I'm not bringing myself, that's a bad sign. It's a bad sign for me, and it's a signal to those around me that something's not right. So I liked the synchronicity of this episode. Before I got sick, I was planning on using this one next. And then when I came back to it, I thought, oh, right, that, all of these things. Don't just be inspirational. Don't just be ignorant or have this hierarchy of ignorance. Be intentional. Bring yourself to what you're doing. All of those things that I just spent 6 weeks not doing, I want to start doing again. And I don't know how often or how emphatically I'll be able to do so, but I'm going to try. So, Benoit, thank you again for recording with me and for keeping touch. You know, we barely knew each other, but you kept up through this ailment and whatever it was, and you've gotten me in touch with other people, and it's just, I really appreciate you. I hope you'll come back and play sometime once I'm recording again. Thank you guys for hanging in there and waiting for me. I will come back downstairs and edit another episode sometime soon, I hope. I don't know. It's not super high on my to-do list when my to-do list includes things like, right, I have to set up my home IV line with nutrition so that I don't die. I mean, sorry if that sounds a little bit dramatic, but that really is where I'm at right now. But I'll be back when I can, because I do miss this, and I like feeling like some part of me is not just the sum total of lab numbers and the shape of a lump in the bed. So, I hope that you're all doing okay, that no one else out there is experiencing the kind of medical insanity that I've been going through. And also, please, honestly, if you're out there, please stop diagnosing me. Like, I have at least 5 different really good departments that are working together. And so, like, I get that you've had Lyme disease or you've had this insufficiency or this parasite or whatever, and that caused all of your symptoms. I appreciate that. But right now, what you're doing is adding more to my brain than I can handle. I will let you know if I reach a point where my doctors say, well, we don't know, ask around. But for right now, checking in and, you know, God, the generosity of people who have sent Grubhub cards is mind-blowing. Things like that, those are emotionally or financially helpful, but things like guessing about whether I have this infection or that bacterial whatever, that's not so helpful. And please don't. And if you can't not, if you just feel this overwhelming urge that you have to type out what it is that you're sure that I have, you could delete it without sending. Because I know that you're coming from a good place and I'm trying to respond charitably and appreciatively, but also it stresses me out. That being said, I do hope you are healthy. I hope you're doing okay. And I hope that you're taking good care of you. You matter.